The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their pieces for you. This week, we're going to be joined by the broadcaster Jonathan Dimbleby, who writes The Diary. We're also going to be joined by the German journalist Katja Hoyer, who talks about the German Green Party and how well they're doing in the polls. And finally, Melissa Kite about why she's perfectly content to stay in the country this summer. First is Jonathan Dimbleby.
I've just had my second jab, and it poses a dilemma. As an assiduous COVID rule taker, I've been appalled by those, including friends and relatives, who flouted or sidestepped the regulations and guidelines in the belief that they don't apply to them. We know we shouldn't, but it's good for us, or we use our common sense, they say. Since the issue is as incendiary as Brexit, I have fumed in silence. Of course, the rules are anomalous and inadequately explained by ministers, but I tend to trust the scientists. That said, the mantra, no one is safe until we're all safe, is clearly nonsensical. Unlike those who are still waiting, I am now as safe as I'm ever going to be. Hence my dilemma. I long to hug my grandchildren, but that would still be to violate the rules. I'm tempted to use my common sense. After all, it will be good for me. And it is all about me, isn't it? It's now exactly 2 years since I told the BBC that I was giving up chairing Radio 4's flagship debate programme, Any Questions. I'm still asked if I regret it, to which I always answer truly that I don't. After 32 years of lost Fridays, I wanted to liberate myself from the BBC's impartiality protocols, important as these are. Yet old habits die hard. This does not mean that I am like the great A.J.P. Taylor, who once told me, and a flutter of other moths around him at a long-ago Spectator party, I have strong opinions weakly held. It is simply that I have come to loathe that loud-mouthed intemperance which passes for lively public debate, an aversion that has been underpinned latterly by reading the foul utterances of Hitler and Goebbels for my new book. So whenever I want to sound off, I try to appear reasonable and measured. Try, that is. The BBC has enough enemies without its friends chipping in, but sometimes a nudge does not come amiss. As you'd expect, the corporation's coverage of Prince Philip's funeral was exemplary, sombre without being sepulchral, and reticent without being obsequious. You would have to be profoundly cynical to have been untouched by those glimpses of that small, frail widow, our head of state, sitting alone, facing her husband's coffin. Nor do you have to be a monarchist to have felt for her family, like any other, but unlike any other, united in mourning their paterfamilias. Too often, though, the national broadcaster fails to apply its customary standards when it comes to this uniquely exposed clan. The BBC News website's account of the toe-curling CBS interview which the Duke and Duchess of Sussex gave to Oprah Winfrey, even as Harry's grandfather was fading away, is a case in point. Abandoning their customary balance, fairness and sense of proportion, its sleuths opted instead for tabloid sensationalism, identifying 12 things we have learned from the couple's decision to share their side of the story. As though there were another side with which we were already familiar, they forbore to point out that no other royal had said a word about the family's private tribulations. There was no hint of scepticism and no reminder that these were unsubstantiated allegations against unnamed individuals who would never answer back. As I write, it is all still up there. It should be taken down and re-edited accordingly. More broadly, when covering such issues, the BBC might keep in mind two lines from Simon Armitage's eloquent funeral elegy. What their secrets were was everyone's guess and nobody's business. My latest book is pretty long, but through narcissism and masochism, I once again elected to voice the audio version myself. This meant 7 long days of non-stop reading from a 600-page manuscript to produce 22 hours of listening. It's a killer. The fluffs, tummy rumbles, coughing bouts, frogs in the throat, sentences like this one that are too long to finish without taking a breath halfway through, as well as those moments when you notice a poorly expressed idea that you start to redraft in your head instead of focusing on the words in front of you. In this case, there were also impenetrably long Russian names. When these loom, it's like Beecher's Brook. You are sure you will stumble and fall, and I usually did. I hope it doesn't show in the final version. Everyone now seems to be gaslighting everyone else. I've had to look up what this buzzword means. Wikipedia says that it derives from a 1938 play called Gaslight, in which an abusive husband manipulates his wife to the point where she feels she's gone mad. Unhappily, the term is now used like a flamethrower in the hands of incontinent pyromaniacs. It should be extinguished before it incinerates us all.
That was Jonathan Dimbleby, and his book Barbarossa is out now. You can also hear him talk about it with Sam Leith on the Spectator's Book Club podcast if you go to spectator.co.uk/thebookclub. Next, it's Katia Hoyer.
Angela Merkel never quite managed to appoint a successor. Her 16 years at the helm of Europe's largest democracy has seen every potential challenger either annihilated or neutered. For all her motherly charms, Mutti Merkel is a merciless political operator. The Christian Democratic Union and its Bavarian sister, the Christian Social Union, seem to have settled on a political incompetent to lead them into September's federal elections. Armin Laschet is, at least for now, set to become the bland, monotone heir to Merkelism, the result of a stitch-up that may yet unravel. Pandemic-stricken Germans are growing tired of the CDU. Roughly a quarter of its voters have melted away since the start of the year. Meanwhile, the country's Green Party is surging. According to one poll, it is comfortably ahead of the CDU. If that prediction proves correct, the party that has never before fielded a candidate for the chancellery could see its newly crowned nominee leading the next German government. "We both wanted it," said a smiling Robert Habeck, as he ushered his victorious rival onto the stage on Monday. But in the end, there could only be one. While the CDU has indulged in months of petty backroom spats, the Greens' co-leaders were able to come to a good-natured agreement over the candidacy. Habeck at a time seemed the favourite, a naturally warm children's author who some German papers have taken to calling Germany's Tony Blair. After a weekend of negotiations with his joint party leader, Annalena Baerbock, the pair decided that the 40-year-old mother of two had a better chance of winning over the German people. The Queen of Greens is the descendant of the movement's long evolution over the last 40 years. Her rise has seen little in the way of scandal. Even her German accent is devoid of any provincial dialect that might grind against the ears of regional voters. Her pleasant middle-class mannerisms are neutral but relaxed. She comes across as a professional and honest politician. A safe pair of hands, but also a new one. Baerbock grew up in Hanover, studying politics and public law at Hamburg and then at LSE. She worked as a journalist before becoming first an MEP's assistant and then a member of the executive board of the Green Party. She briefly hoped to become a professional athlete, winning bronze at the German trampoline championships 3 times. Last year, she was invited to an elite finishing school run by the organisers of Davos, from which Jacinda Ardern, Emmanuel Macron and Mark Zuckerberg graduated. She is the archetypical career politician. The Green Party in Germany is not the socialist project of Extinction Rebellion. In many ways, it is further to the right than the British Conservatives. In November, the party launched a zero-tolerance plan to tackle Muslim extremism, calling for a boost of police powers and a ban on Salafi organisations. Meanwhile, the Greens have successfully run Baden-Württemberg, Germany's 3rd largest state since 2011, where self-confessed Green conservative Winfried Kretschmann, the minister-president, has fought against tax increases and in favour of pro-market policies. The proud diesel-driving Catholic also takes a tough line on migrant gangs, arguing that the most dangerous thing that human evolution has produced is hordes of young men. Kretschmann was re-elected earlier this year on an increased majority. The appeal of the German Greens lies in their centrism. Both Baerbock and Habeck have relentlessly stressed the party's status as a Bündnispartei, a coalition party, willing to work with others in order to get things done. Its ecological politics are broad and popular, promoting renewables, protecting the environment, and promising new green jobs. But it opposes Nord Stream 2, Merkel's dream of an oil pipeline flowing from Russia that many see as the cause of her ambivalence towards Putin. Berlin's Western allies would be only too happy to see the Kremlin's crude tentacles cut back. The Greens have not always been a centrist party of compromise. They entered the Bundestag in the 1980s wearing jeans and handmade jumpers. Their deputies were known for knitting during parliamentary sessions. The party's roots draw on Germany's Romanticist tradition as well as on the pacifist, feminist and environmentalist movements. The party's appeal widened following the development of America's Pershing II missiles on German soil and the Chernobyl disaster in 1986. There was a struggle early on between the fundamentalists and the realists. The so-called Realos eventually won, and they joined state coalitions with the mainstream parties, entering federal government with Gerhard Schröder's SPD in 1998. As the country's first Green minister, Joschka Fischer, finally turned his back on his party's traditional roots by supporting military intervention in Kosovo, along with welfare cuts. He had begun his political career as a student activist during the 1970s. Photos emerged years later of the young protester ambushing and beating a member of the Bundespolizei. Merkel's election in 2005 put an end to his time in government as foreign minister and vice-chancellor. Joschka's children, as they are known, are now in with a real chance of ending the era of CDU supremacy. Whatever the outcome of the election, it looks as though Baerbock's party will prove a critical coalition partner. The Queen of Greens is set to become Germany's kingmaker.
That was Katia Hoyer. And finally, it's Melissa Kite.
Trying to get hold of HRT in the time of COVID is like trying to score crack. Possibly scoring crack is way easier than trying to persuade your GP to do your annual blood pressure test so you can renew your prescription while the nurse who does the blood pressure testing is socially distancing. I can't be sure, obviously. While they don't much want to wrap a strap around my arm and press a button, they are very keen on sticking a syringe into me. The vaccine call-up came in a text from the NHS the day before my blood pressure test, which they finally decided to give me after attempting to do it over the phone, despite me pointing out this wouldn't work. They texted me to say I could now book my vaccine. I ignored it and explained to a friend why. "No, no, no," he wailed passionately. "The government is doing everything it can to keep you safe, or you would moan that they hadn't done enough to protect you." "I'm not the sort to moan," I said, as he raised his eyebrows. "Seriously, even though I do detest the modern world, I am a self-starter when it comes to coping. I don't want the state to look after me. I want to be left alone to look after myself. I wouldn't trust the authorities to run a bath because I look at what they are advising and I see that it is plain lunacy. As soon as the lockdown eased, the first thing they did was get as many people as possible back to the pubs to drink themselves fatter and re-bugger their immune systems. The official response to a deadly flu that has killed tens of thousands is to souse the population in as much booze as possible and encourage them to indulge in the sort of behaviour that laid the population low enough to be susceptible to COVID so badly in the first place. But no, apparently I'm the problem. Me, bang on 9 stone coming out of winter on my boring old low-fat, low-sugar, no-alcohol, outdoorsy lifestyle. I had a touch of COVID in February 2020, or so I suspect. I wrote about it at the time. I felt sick, then came a blinding headache, then I couldn't get enough air in my lungs. It felt like the time I got altitude sickness near the summit of Kilimanjaro and had to be taken back down the mountain by a porter. I lay on the bedroom floor and did yogic breathing while the builder boyfriend refused to entertain the notion I was ill enough to be taken to hospital, as he doesn't like to indulge me. Having apparently had it and recovered, I'm entitled to think I've got antibodies that are up to the job. Why do I have to have artificial ones injected into me? I know that's a downer for the COVID-phobic brigade who want us all vaccinated for two reasons. One, so they can carry on being unhealthy, and two, so they can book their villa. When they say, do your bit for your country, what they mean is, do your bit for my holiday. No, I'm not getting an under-tested vaccine so the bourgeoisie can go to the gastropub to get wasted on Pinot Grigio while boasting about their trip to the Algarve. It's them being drunk and obsessed with foreign travel that's got us in this mess in the first place. Well, they've had their jabs, so I wish them bon voyage. I'm happy to stay at home and never go anywhere again if that is what freedom means now. Let the vaccinated classes fly away to the sun. They think that means they're free, but they're not free. It's an illusion. I'm the one who's free, stuck at home in chilly England, with my natural antibodies coursing through my veins, washing my hands several hundred times a day, as I was before it was fashionable, thanks to my OCD. How are you feeling? Said the nurse as she collected me from the waiting room of the deserted surgery, which had four chairs placed 20 metres apart in each corner of the empty room. Oh, I'm very well, I declared. She strapped the machine to my arm and pressed the button. Oh dear, she said. She did it again and the machine malfunctioned. She told me to sit back and breathe before doing it a third time, but the same figure as the first time came up. She told me I could either book an appointment to come back and be fitted with a monitor, or I could buy one online and send the readings in myself. I'm sure you're fine, she said, not looking me in the eye.
That was Melissa Kite. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. If you like this podcast, do rate and review us, and why not tell a friend about it too? Remember, if you enjoy these articles and other similar ones like it, you can pick up an issue of the magazine and we'll even throw in a £20 Amazon voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.